It's not a bad idea. It's an idea that if a politician running for president were to embrace, I might get on board with that. I could deal with a year of mandatory military service for everyone in this country. I think part of the problem we have in this country right now is that we have an entire generation now that hasn't been exposed to military the way that my generation was, the way that my parents' generation was. I mean, you don't have the draft anymore. There's still a lot of kids that go into the military. They go into the military because it's the only option they have, or it's the best option they have, in some cases because they really want to. But it's not mandatory. We have to register for the draft, but nobody sits around thinking they're really going to have to go. You know, my generation, we actually had a moment in 1991 after Iraq invaded Kuwait when we didn't know what was going to happen. And we were all sitting around saying, you know, we all signed up for the draft. Are we going over there? And we didn't know. I had one friend that was desperately trying to get over there, really wanted to go and serve his country. Fortunately, that war wound up being very efficient and very quick. And by the time he even got to the point, my friend Wayne even got to the point of talking to people, it was over. And they weren't, but they may have mobilized hundreds of thousands of Americans and said, you got to go over there. And that would have been me. And that would have been all my classmates. And we would have done it. So maybe that's a good idea. A lot of countries require, they're typically smaller countries, but a lot of countries require a year of military service. And you know what? That forces you to care about your country, forces you to understand how the military works, gets you in shape, and gives you the opportunity. I think if you turn them into sort of, you know, a United States version of the Peace Corps, you might actually get a lot of good stuff done in this country. Let them go, you know, let them go take down abandoned properties. Let them go build playgrounds. Let them clean up parks. Let them clean up rivers. Somebody should get on board with this. Mandatory year of military service. The other thing that I'll point to is pro football. Everybody likes to talk about how divided we are in this country. And if you listen to the show, you know I'm a football fan. You know I'm a Pats season ticket holder. I'm crazy, okay? Yeah, I know about the brain injury thing. Don't want to hear about it. So I don't want to hear about it. I understand it. It needs to be fixed. It's not germane to what I'm saying right now. So don't take that cavalier comment as a sign of not caring. I look at football, and I see people, you take a football team, a professional football team, and this is going to play into what we're about to talk about. You take a look at a professional football team, and you will see people of every economic background, every racial background, every religious background. You'll see people from different countries, people from all over the world. We have someone from Denmark. Those are my people playing for the offensive line for the Patriots this preseason. Don't know if he's going to make the team or not, but it's cool that there's a Dane out there. They share a common goal, everybody in the NFL. If you're on an NFL team, if you're playing professional football, you're there for one reason. You are there to win the Super Bowl. And the whole process of scouting and drafting and practice is designed to figure out who really wants that. If you're just there to get a paycheck, you're not making the team unless you are supremely talented. If you're a generational talent, okay, if you're Megatron, if you're Beast Mode, if you're AJ Green, I'd put on that list. If you are pre-year off Le'Veon Bell, and you are just a supremely talented, superhuman football player, yeah, you can get on a roster and collect a check. But really what everybody's looking for is people that want to win the Super Bowl. Because playing professional football is not fun. Those guys go out there and put their bodies at risk every play, every game, every Sunday, or Thursday, or Monday, or whatever night of the week it is we're playing football now. Those guys expose themselves to a huge amount of risk. They play through pain. They play through sickness. They play through exhaustion. They play through personal tragedy. They play alongside people that they might otherwise never have met. And in the NFL, you're going to find racists, you're going to find homophobes, you're going to find all of these kinds of people. But they have to set that aside. You cannot sit in that locker room and be a racist, because you will not be a functional part of the team. and to climb that mountain, which so few human beings will ever climb, to win the Super Bowl, just to get to the Super Bowl. There's fewer than 75 football players do that in any given year, get to the Super Bowl. Just to get there, superhuman effort. So if you're that good and that dedicated, you don't have time for racism. You don't have time for sexism. The shared goal makes the difference. I've got a caller on the line, so let me throw on a PSA very, very quickly. Take this, and we will be back in just 1 second. I got to find a long one. Inevitably, I need a long one. Here we go.
This is Steven Pinker, and you are tuned in to WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM, pure pleasure technology, Tufts freeform and educational radio.
Leave your kids behind, come with us and find the pleasures of the journey to the center of the mind.
And we are back. It is WMFO Medford. So I look at pro football, and we talk about how divided everybody is in America these days, right? I look at pro football, and I see people from all these different backgrounds, people from all these different experiences, people who ordinarily may walk down the street and be like, I don't like you. You know, I don't like your kind. You can't do that on a football team. So what is the difference? What makes all of this come together? It's the shared goal. The shared goal of winning that Super Bowl will at least make people pretend to tolerate each other. And I think if you can get people to pretend to tolerate each other, and you throw them on the road, and you throw them in hotels together, and on buses and planes and locker rooms together for 4 or 5 years, they're not pretending after a while. Sooner or later, you realize, you know what? Whatever I thought about that guy was wrong. Whatever bias I brought into this, I was wrong. Because I've watched that guy play football, and that guy can play football. And I'm proud to have that guy on my team. I'm proud to know that guy. And whenever you watch the Hall of Fame ceremonies or anything like this. You see the brotherhood of these players, and you see how united they are. There are very few aspects of daily life in America, because football is a job. Football is daily life for these guys. And there are very few aspects of daily life in America where something like that is on display for all of us to see. And it's one of the reasons I like football. I think football is a great thing for us to emulate, not in the sense that we're running around bashing our heads against each other, but in the sense that you take a group of people and you bring them together for a common goal. And because they have a passion to reach that goal, it brings out the best in the individual, and it brings out the best in each other. So we get on to the topic of why we're divided. Fascinating article in The Atlantic. This is written by Daniel Markovitz, who is a professor at Yale Law School. And he has written a book called The Meritocracy Trap. And this is an excerpt from his new book, The Meritocracy Trap. And it's called How Life Became an Endless, Terrible Competition. And this gets a little long, so I'm going to skip through it. But I strongly, strongly recommend this. You will find this on theatlantic.com. How Life Became an Endless, Terrible Competition. Daniel Markovitz says, in the summer of 1987, I graduated from a public high school in Austin, Texas. Same year I graduated, by the way. And headed northeast to attend Yale. I then spent nearly 15 years studying at various universities, picking up a string of degrees along the way. Today, I teach at Yale Law, where my students unnervingly resemble my younger self. They are, overwhelmingly, products of professional parents and high-class universities. I pass on to them the advantages that my own teachers bestowed on me. They and I owe our prosperity and our caste to meritocracy. 2 decades ago, when I started writing about economic inequality, meritocracy seemed more likely a cure than a cause. Meritocracy's early advocates championed social mobility. In the 1960s, for instance, Yale President Kingman Brewster brought meritocratic admissions to the university with the express aim of breaking a hereditary elite. Alumni had long believed that their sons had a birthright to follow them to Yale. Now prospective students would gain admission based on achievement rather than breeding. Meritocracy, for a time, replaced complacent insiders with talented and hardworking outsiders. This is true. And that is the age that I grew up in. Up until 1965, 1966, a little bit later at some schools. If one or both of your parents went to a school, and this was primarily what was happening at the Ivy League colleges, if your parents or a parent went to Harvard or went to Yale or went to Princeton or one of the other Ivies, and you had the right last name, you were pretty much guaranteed admission. You were going to get in. Well, I'm a Rothsfeller. All of the Rothsfellers have gone to Harvard, you know. And they'd look at the application and say, oh, Rothsfeller. Have to let the Rothsfellers in. Didn't matter if the kid was actually qualified. Kid could have been a complete screw-up. Kid could have been a drunk. Kid could have been, you know, kid could have had an IQ of 50. But he's a Rothsfeller. All the Rothsfellers have gone to Harvard. So Harvard takes the Rothsfellers. Point of note, I applied to Harvard University and actually got an interview with them. So I think they may have confused me with the Garys related to the direct descendants of the former vice president who were in Cambridge and Marblehead and not realized that I wasn't one of those Garys and said, hey, we've got a Gary trying to get in here. And then they were like, oh, no, it's one of the main Garys. And we don't want them. But I at least got an interview out of it. So I was considered. And I was considered seriously. I wound up going to Boston University, which is an excellent school. It's no Tufts. I have to say that. Honestly, I have to say that. But I wound up going to a good school. No one from my high school, by the way. We got into Harvard University after graduation. None of us were named Rothsfeller. But the way that it worked was, if you were a Rothsfeller or a Stone child or whatever, you were going to get in. And the best and the brightest, the smartest kids couldn't get in because the freshman class is full of Rothsfellers who are legacies. And university presidents like Kingman Brewster looked at this and they said, you know what? What are we missing? What opportunities are we losing? What minds are we losing? What products, what ideas, what cures for disease, what scientific breakthroughs are we missing? Because we're letting these dumb Rothsfeller kids in here when there's some black kid who's super smart and super promising and we won't take him in because we're letting all these elites in. No more. No more of this. We're not here to reinforce the elites anymore. We're going to let that poor black kid in. And we're going to let that poor black kid get a great education and go cure cancer or go become an astrophysicist or go run a business. That is a huge moment in American society. That is a massive moment in American society because that is a moment where the system that was perpetuating the elite patriarchy of the founding fathers and the founding families and the well-to-do said, no, we turn our backs on this. And they did it at great risk, and the alumni were not happy. But educators banded together and said, you know what, this is the right thing to do. Because if we're going to be competitive, if we are going to be a great nation, if we are going to be a great school, we can't just have the same 200 families sending their students here while everybody else is trying to get in and can't get an education. Meritocracy now excludes everyone outside of a narrow elite. This is what our friend, Professor Markovitz, his current conclusion. Today's meritocrats still claim to get ahead through talent and effort using means open to anyone. In practice, however, meritocracy now excludes everyone outside of a narrow elite. Harvard, Princeton, Stanford, and Yale collectively enroll more students from households in the top 1% of the income distribution than from households in the bottom 60%. This is not how it was supposed to work. Legacy preferences, they still exist. You got to be smart. You got to have the numbers. You got to have the public service. But legacy is a factor. Nepotism and outright fraud, we recall the college admissions scandal from this past spring, continue to give rich applicants corrupt advantages. But the dominant causes of this skew toward wealth can be traced to meritocracy. On average, children whose parents make more than $100,000 a year score about 250 points higher on the SAT than children whose parents make $40,000 to $60,000. Only about 1 in 200 children from the poorest third of households achieves SAT scores at Yale's median, 1 in 200. Meanwhile, the top banks and law firms, along with other high-paying employers, recruit almost exclusively from a few elite colleges. This was the point of meritocracy. This was the point. As I said, these Ivy League schools were the ones that kept the patriarchy in power. And the way it worked is, you're a Rothschild, you have a Rothschild child, you send your Rothschild child to Harvard University, and then they go work at Goldman Sachs, where everyone is from Harvard University. Meanwhile, the poor black kid, who might be better qualified, brighter, better ideas, more talented, never gets an opportunity to enter that world. Meritocracy was designed to create those opportunities. So what happens? The fundamental corruption of meritocracy has to do with the means that are available to the rich. If you make more than $100,000 a year, you can afford to send your kid to the best private schools so that they have the right education, so that they have the highest SAT scores. Some of these kids do nothing but drill for SATs from 8th grade through 11th grade. To make sure their numbers are good enough to get in. And when they're not doing that, they're overachieving in three different sports. They're volunteering, okay? They're running their own business somewhere. Or they're becoming a superstar on YouTube. These kids have every single minute of their day from the time they turn 5 years old and enter kindergarten. Sometimes earlier than that, from the time they turn 3 years old. Parents are competing to get into the right nursery school now. Oh, you got to get in the right pre-K program, or you're never going to get in the right elementary school. And if you don't get in the right elementary school, you can forget about getting in the right high school, and then no Harvard. This is what we're doing to kids. Why? Because there are far more kids trying to get into these schools than there are available spaces. That's problem number one. Problem number two is what the professor points out. And this is the bigger problem. The top banks and law firms. Oh my God, where did you go? Why? I didn't click on that. The top banks and law firms, along with other high paying employers, recruit almost exclusively from a few elite colleges. You want to be a king in the United States of America, you got to get that Ivy League education. We're only going to take 1% of our applicants. And the first thing we're going to do is look at everybody's numbers, and we're just going to start cutting people off because they don't have the right numbers. Then we're going to look at whether or not they've participated in sports. Are they great at sports? Prior to meritocracy, by the way, sports was the way that kids got in. If you were a good athlete, didn't matter. Because all of these schools sat around and they're like, well, we're going to win the Harvard-Yale football game this year. And we've recruited some young black fellows to play alongside the Rothschilds so that we can win the Harvard-Yale football game this year. The alumni get by on that, and a few kids would get through. This was what gave educators the idea in the first place, was they'd look at these kids that were brought in on athletic scholarships, and they'd say, these kids are brilliant. Why aren't we giving more opportunities to these kids? And why are all these dumb kids of, you know, Newport and New York City and Boston? Why are they all hanging around here? These kids are never going to amount to anything. Go get me some kids that are smart, that are motivated, that have ideas. That's how it was supposed to work. You kid from the wrong side of the tracks, you go to the Ivy League, you get the job at Goldman Sachs. You got the job at Wells Fargo. You got to go work at the State Department. You get to be somebody. And as those people get up into the higher levels of those companies, they will hire people who went to their schools. Okay? The problem is, the rich looked at this and they said, well, there's a way to win this game. And the way to win this game is to train and drill my child like it is a machine so that this child gets into the school. Public anger over economic inequality frequently targets meritocratic institutions. Nearly three-fifths of Republicans believe that colleges and universities are bad for America, according to the Pew Research Center. The intense and widespread fury generated by the college admissions scandal early this year tapped into a deep and broad well of resentment. This anger is warranted, but also distorting. Outrage at nepotism and other disgraceful forms of elite advantage taking implicitly valorizes meritocratic ideals, yet meritocracy itself is the bigger problem, and it is crippling the American dream. Meritocracy has created a competition that, even when everyone plays by the rules, only the rich can win. And this is where this gets interesting. But what exactly have the rich won? Even meritocracy's beneficiaries now suffer on account of its demands. It ensnares the rich just as surely as it excludes the rest, as those who manage to claw their way to the top must work with crushing intensity, ruthlessly exploiting their expensive education in order to extract a return. No one should weep for the wealthy. I'm liking this guy. I really am. But the harms that meritocracy imposes on them are both real and important. Diagnosing how meritocracy hurts elites kindles hope for a cure. We are accustomed to thinking that reducing inequality requires burdening the rich. But because meritocratic inequality does not in fact serve anyone well, escaping meritocracy's trap would benefit virtually everyone. So there's a lot said in those two paragraphs. And from there, he goes on to describe basically what I've talked about, which is how hard everybody is working. Kids are being treated like robots to make sure they get into the right kindergarten, to get into the right to get into the right elementary school, to get into the right high school, to get into the right college. All they do is work. Every moment of every day is scheduled. We had childhood when I was a kid. I enjoyed it. We had teenage years. But this is the pressure that parents put on their kids. And the parents are under the same pressure. Because as the professor goes on to say, if you get into that environment, which is full of these hard-charging people who have been driven their entire lives to pursue and pursue and pursue, you have to keep up. This is why we don't take vacations. This is why we don't spend time with our families. This is why we don't do things that we like anymore. Because we are expected to work our butts off just to keep pace with everybody. If you want to get ahead, you got to work twice as hard. And he brings up the example that promotion doesn't mean that you're in charge of people anymore. Promotion now means that you're taking on more work. That's what it is. Oh, if you're going to get a promotion, you're going to work even harder than you do now. It doesn't really work that way. As he says, today, the higher a person climbs on the org chart, the harder she is expected to work. Amazon's leadership principles call for managers to have relentlessly high standards and to deliver results. The company tells managers that when they hit the wall at work, the only solution is to climb the wall. Americans who work more than 60 hours a week report that they would, on average, prefer 25 fewer weekly hours. They say this because work subjects them to a time famine that a 2006 study found interferes with their capacity to have strong relationships with their spouse and children, to maintain their home, and even to have a satisfying sex life. A respondent to a recent Harvard Business School survey of executives proudly insisted, quote, "The 10 minutes that I give my kids at night is 1 million times greater than spending that 10 minutes at work." The professor follows that quote by saying, 10 minutes, exclamation point. That's all this executive has to give his son or his kids, 10 minutes at night. The capacity to bear these hours gracefully, or at least grimly, has become a criterion for meritocratic success. And this is 100% true. This is where Amazon says, when you hit the wall, climb the wall. There is no room for weakness. There is no room for mental health. There is no room for physical health. You go to work and you work every single day, day after day after day. You show up and you perform no matter what. And if you can't handle it, the people who are up above you are going to recognize that, and you're not going to go anywhere. You're never going to get promoted. You're probably not going to get pay increases. They're going to find the people that can stand up to that kind of punishment and keep going. That is a problem. And that is taking a toll on all of us. So the professor offers some solutions in here. And this is one of them. For one thing, education, whose benefits are concentrated in the extravagantly trained children of rich parents, must become open and inclusive. Private schools and universities, this is one of the most interesting ideas that you're going to hear. And once again, I would like to hear our presidential candidates weigh in on this. Private schools and universities should lose their tax-exempt status unless at least half of their students come from families in the bottom two-thirds of the income distribution. And public subsidies should encourage schools to meet this requirement by expanding enrollment. That is a brilliant idea. Now, we all know what's going on here in Boston with the universities. And the PILOT, as it's known, program. That's P-I-L-O-T. It's an acronym. Payment in lieu of taxes. Harvard University, Boston University, Emerson University, Northeastern University, Boston College up there in Newton, own some pretty valuable real estate. They don't pay taxes on that real estate. They make payment in lieu of taxes because they are, quote, nonprofit organizations. The payment in lieu of taxes is a fraction of what the city would get if it told the university to kick rocks and develop that land. And the taxes that the city would get from developing that land would be enough to provide better schools, affordable housing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But because we got this old university here, oh, it's prestigious, you know, every now and again, you know, MIT will come up with some energy solutions or let us borrow some energy from their nuclear plant. And yeah, let them stay around. They don't have to pay taxes. They go to the universities and they're like, we would like if you would pay the equivalent of what your taxes would be. And the universities smile and nod and say, yeah, that's not going to happen. Because they're tax exempt. Because the city and the state cannot touch them. This is a good idea. Let me tell you this idea one more. Private schools and universities should lose their tax exempt status unless at least half of their students come from families in the bottom two-thirds of the income distribution. Poor kids. Lower middle class kids. Poor kids. Two-thirds of your student body is poor kids, or you lose your tax-exempt status. Good idea. I like it. A parallel policy agenda must reform work by favoring goods and services produced by workers who do not have elaborate training or fancy degrees. I've been saying this for years. Years. Listen to this again. A parallel policy agenda must reform work by favoring goods and services produced by workers who do not have elaborate training or fancy degrees. For example, the healthcare system should emphasize public health, preventive care, and other measures that can be overseen primarily by nurse practitioners rather than high-tech treatments that require specialist doctors. I've said this on this show before. I will say this on this show again. The idea that you have to go to college and get a college degree to be valuable is nonsense. It is a creation of the college industrial complex and Democrat politicians who emerged from the college industrial complex. Some Republicans too, but this is primarily a thing that the Democrats harp on. Everybody's going to get a college education. Everybody doesn't need a college education. We live in a country with 300 million people in it. 330 million, I think, is our current total. We don't have the means to educate everybody. Everybody's not going to go to college. It's not going to happen. We don't need everybody to go to college. What we need is a society that looks at a barber, that looks at a shopkeeper, that looks at somebody who manufactures hammers, or manufactures floor mats for cars, with the same reverence and the same value that we have when we look at the banker and the lawyer and the stockbroker. We have to recognize that there is more to work than just being a mover of markets or a leader of men. We need to restore dignity to all jobs. And you restore dignity to all jobs by paying better wages. It's one of the reasons why I support the higher minimum wage. I think it's a good idea. I think we need to do that. Somebody is on the phone. I'm going to throw on a PSA and take this. And we will be right back here on WMFO Medford.
I am Dr. Lester Grinspoon, Associate Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Back in 1966, concerned that so many young people were harming themselves through the use of marijuana, I began to review the medical and scientific literature to help clarify the nature of this harmfulness. Much to my surprise, I discovered that it was a substance remarkably free of toxicity. In fact, it is far safer than any pharmaceutical or recreational drug. There is no record of a single overdose death from its recreational or medicinal use. Marijuana is one of the most studied substances. I believe that it is high time that this country reconsider its stance on cannabis.
Them legalize marijuana.
Smoke dope, kids. I guess that's the message now. Smoke dope, kids. I still say you probably shouldn't smoke dope unless you're over 21, but yeah, don't smoke dope unless you're over 21. But that's where we're at now. Back to meritocracy. I support a $20 an hour minimum wage. And I understand that it creates problems. I understand that it's painful for small business, okay? I also understand that we cannot continue to live in a society where the only people who are earning and the only people who have value are the people at the top of organizations. This is not the way things were when I grew up, okay? When I was growing up, back in the 1970s and the early 1980s, everybody respected, well, respect may be too strong of a word, but everybody respected the lawyer. Everybody respected the doctor. Everybody respected the architect. Everybody respected the chief of police and the fire chief. And we understand that those people earned a lot of money because they were highly skilled, highly trained, highly experienced, and had a tremendous amount of responsibility. And they made more money than pretty much everybody else did. And kids grow up and they're going to be like, I want to be a doctor. I want to be a dentist. I want to be a lawyer. And parents would be like, my child wants to be a professional. And everybody was excited. Then the kid flunks out of pre-med because he's drinking too much during freshman year. And the parents are embarrassed. That's where we came from. And back in those days, people who ran businesses, unless you were the name, you know, unless you were Fred Trump, unless you were one of the Johnson brothers, unless you were Dr. Kellogg or something, you weren't making a lot of money. The people that owned the businesses got to take a chunk of the profits and put them in their pocket and say, ha ha, look at me. I am a captain of industry. But everybody that did the work, all the managers, all the middle managers, all of those people, all the pretty much earned the same amount of money. There's infographics you can find online that will show you, you know, as recently as the 1970s. Managers earned somewhere around 15 times the median of employees. So that's not a lot. They're making 15% more than their employees are, and they have a lot more responsibility. But they're there primarily to organize people and manage people, not to do the work of five other people. And you can make the case that in this current corporate environment, you know, at a certain point, we all become executives and we're all doing executive levels of work and executive volume of work. And yeah, we should be sitting around saying, where's my seven-figure paycheck? But that's only one tiny part of the economy. Banking is only one part of the economy. They're getting all the money, right? The senior executives are getting all the money. People who sit around the C-suite. have time to go play golf during the day. You need them for something, and you have no idea where they are. They make a few decisions a week and walk home with millions of dollars at the end of the year. Meanwhile, everybody else is scraping by, lower middle class. That's assuming you could even get into one of those companies because you got a college education. Now, when I was growing up, it wasn't a default that you were going to go to college. It was highly encouraged. And I think out of my graduating class, at least three quarters of us went to college. And it was one of the highest percentages in the history of the school of people who'd gone to college. And I know people who went to college. I went to college. I know people who went and did well for themselves. One of my friends is an engineer and works with concrete and goes all over the world consulting on buildings and bridges and infrastructure because he is one of the world's experts on concrete formulation. I think that's super cool. I got another friend who's an astrophysicist. Doesn't make a lot of money, but he gets to play with the Hubble Space Telescope. And he gets papers published. I think that's cool. I have other friends who are cops and firefighters who have done well for themselves. They went to college. They went to the academy. They got their training. I have friends who are landscapers who have done well for themselves. Never set foot inside of a classroom after high school. Got their diploma and said and went to work. And have done very well for themselves. College is not necessary. I don't say this to discourage any of the freshmen wandering around the Tufts campus or anybody who's coming to college this year. If you want to go to college and you have the means to go to college, you should go to college. Okay? It never hurts anyone to get more education. But you have to understand that what you're doing is investing in your future. And if you're making an investment, if you're spending $200,000, $150,000, and you don't know what you're going to do on the other side of that, you're not spending it to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer or a senior executive, a business person or an accountant or a teacher. Someday we'll talk about teachers and how I think you're getting ripped off on the whole college thing. If you are not going to college for that, why are you going? If you're going to college because everybody else is going to college, don't go to college. Figure out what you want to do. Okay? Nobody would look at the stock market and say, hey, you know what? I got $100,000. I'm just gonna buy some stuff. I'm gonna buy baseballs because I like baseball, and I'm gonna buy raincoats because it rains sometimes, I guess, and it's nice to have a raincoat. And you just put my money in that. We'll see what happens. Nobody invests like that. You'd be crazy if you invested like that. But this is what we're doing, and worse than that, the parents get involved. And they got the kids on the treadmill from the time they're 3 or 4 years old. So by the time these kids are 18, they're depressed. They're increasingly suicidal. They're on drugs. They're burnt out. And the only thing that they understand, the only thing that's meaningful to them, is getting into a good college. Because that will somehow make the last 13 years of misery worthwhile. They will have worked hard and achieved their goal. Well, good for that. What do you have to show for it? This is why I thoroughly agree that we must reform work. We must put value into everything that people do. We can't sit around and look at retail employees anymore and say, you know what, you're $7.50 an hour. Go work a second job. And by the way, one of the realities here that kind of gets lost in this discussion. People look at the 1% and they say, look at all the money. They're like, oh my God, they make all this money and I have to work three jobs just to get by. The point that the professor and the author of this article is making is the people who are making that money are working just as hard as the people working three jobs and spending just as little time with their families as the people working three jobs. The difference is they're getting more pay for it. So that's a benefit. But it's not a situation where, hey, you know what, I'm 9 to 5 and I'm making 7 figures a year. Goodbye. That doesn't exist in this country anymore. You want the money, you got to put in the hours. So you're either putting in the hours working three jobs and never seeing your family, or you're putting in the hours working one job and never seeing your family. Neither one of those is good. Neither one of those is relevant. So you get to this question of, Well, how are we going to pay retail employees $20 an hour? How do you pay the McDonald's employee $20 an hour? How do we pay farm laborers $20 an hour? Because we got all the money floating to the top. Everybody up the top is trying to grab as much as they can. It has to start up there. It has to start at the top. And it starts with a question. And the way that you break this system, this is not something that everybody can participate in. If you're at the bottom, you're going to be a beneficiary of this if you can get people thinking the right way. The way that you break this system is to have the people at the top ask a simple question. And that question is this: how much is enough? How much is enough? You need $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $10 million, 5 houses, 20 houses. How much is enough? At what point have you amassed enough that there's no point in amassing anymore? Some of the smartest people in this hard-charging generation, and this goes back to my generation, certainly includes some millennials. We will see it from Generation Z. Some of the smartest people get on that treadmill at the age of 3. They get into college, and they see an exit plan. They say, you know what? I go to the elite school. I can go work as a stockbroker. I can make $10 million by the time I'm 35, and I'm done. And if you want to know where those people wind up, take a drive up to Vermont. Vermont is full of them. People who retired in their 30s and 40s after busting their butts for the first half of their lives and then just walked away with a pocket full of money because they said this. They put a number down on a piece of paper and they said, this is enough. Once I get here, I'm done. And the faster you get there, the faster you get to walk away. This is the question that we need to ask. This is the question the people at the top need to ask. How much is enough? What are you doing this for? Is it for the money? Is it for the power? Is it for the recognition? How much is enough? And if you sit down and you ask yourself that question and answer that question honestly, you find a point where you can stop. You find a point where you can step away from this and live life the way that you are meant to live it. Not working yourself crazy every single day until you die a premature death. If the people at the top start asking that question, how much is enough, and putting a number on it and walking away, guess what happens? When they walk away, the next group gets to move up, and so on and so on and so on. And as people start grabbing less and needing less to sustain them, we have more to share at the lower end of the economic spectrum. This is where this book is going. And I, as I mentioned at the top, you'll find this on Atlantic, theatlantic.com, How Life Became an Endless Terrible Competition, written by Daniel Markovitz, author of The Meritocracy Trap. I highly recommend you give this a read because confirmation bias. I've been thinking about a lot of these things for a long time. And every now and again, I will read something and I'll say, aha, this person gets it. And it's not confirmation bias like, you know what, all Republicans are bad people and this guy thinks Republicans are bad people. I'm talking about things that I don't think anybody else in the world is thinking about. Like, you know, what's the intersection between the university education and income inequality and all the rest of that? Most people aren't sitting around thinking about this. This guy is. This guy's been studying this. And he's on to something here. The book is called The Meritocracy Trap. Available where finer books are sold online. That means you're getting it at Amazon. By Daniel Markovitz. He's got a preview of it on The Atlantic. Strongly suggest you check it out. Before we head into the final stretch on the Talent Mikey D coming your way in just about 15 minutes. I talked about the recession last week and the possibility of a recession. And I said it is very likely a self-fulfilling prophecy. Okay, because everybody on Wall Street freaks out. Everybody on Wall Street gets spooked and they start looking for signs of a recession. And any little thing they see, suddenly they're like, oh, here it comes. It's the recession. Well, there are two companies that you want to keep an eye on, which are considered the canaries in the coal mine of the U.S. economy. Those companies are United Parcel Service, which is a measurement of online retail health and general business health. Because when UPS is shipping a lot of stuff, it means businesses are selling a lot of stuff. The other companies that you want to keep an eye on are Home Depot and Lowe's. Because Home Depot and Lowe's do their best when people are buying houses and improving their houses, which are things that people do when the economy is healthy. From CNBC, Home Depot stock rises on better-than-expected profits, even as the company lowers outlook on tariff worries. Home Depot shares claimed more than 4.5% Tuesday after the retailer released a mixed earnings report that didn't appear to haunt investors. Home Depot's fiscal second quarter sales missed analysts' expectations, and the company lowered its sales outlook for the year amid fears that the trade war will slow consumer spending. But its earnings topped estimates, and analysts say that positions Home Depot well for the back half of 2019. This paragraph tells you everything, if you understand markets and how to read it. So let me go through it piece by piece. Home Depot's fiscal second quarter, that should be, I don't know how they break it down. Every company does it a little differently. The fiscal year doesn't always match the calendar year. But if they're reporting second quarter earnings in August, their second quarter should run April, May, June. It may run May, June, July. That'd be weird. It's probably April, May, June. So, spring. Home Depot's fiscal second quarter sales missed analysts' expectations. So analysts sat around and they said, you know what? We think they're going to sell $50 million worth of stuff. Home Depot shows up and like, you know, we only sold $45 million. Analysts freak out. They're like, we thought you were going to sell 50. You only sold 45. Panic. The company lowered its sales outlook for the year. Analysts sit there, panic. Amid fears, here's that word, that the trade war will slow consumer spending. There is no evidence that that's going to happen. We've never been in a trade war before. Not in our lifetimes. Maybe the greatest generation remembers a trade war. I don't remember a trade war in the 20th century. I don't think we had one after 1945. We were too busy fighting world wars and fighting Russia and having a Cold War to have a trade war. I don't recall any trade wars. So what you have is a bunch of people sitting around saying, oh, you know, trade war. We don't think people are going to spend money anymore because of the trade war. Well, do people even understand what the trade war is? Again, the most important word in that sentence is fears. And then we get to the rest of this paragraph. But Home Depot's earnings topped estimates, so they didn't sell as much stuff. And this is what analysts do. Analysts sit around and they say, okay, Home Depot is going to sell $50 million worth of stuff. And they're going to earn $1 a share. Then Home Depot comes in and they're like, you really sold $45 million worth of stuff. But we made $1.05 a share. So they actually made more profit off of lower sales. Analysts say that positions Home Depot well for the back half of 2019. In other words, nobody knows what's going on here. Home Depot sold less stuff than they thought they would, than Wall Street thought they would, made more profit than Wall Street thought they would. And now they're saying, well, trade war, people might stop renovating their homes. Everyone's, I guess we're all going to go out and buy water and batteries and canned food because the trade war is coming. Maybe we're going to go load up on iPhones before the tariffs kick in and make iPhones more expensive so we won't be buying shingles or new appliances. Nobody knows. And as I said last week, what is ruling the market right now is fear. Everybody thinks something bad is going to happen because the market has been positive for too long. And they sit around and they say, this can't go on forever. We're all going to die. So this is actually a pretty middle-of-the-road report, second quarter report for Home Depot. But because they missed their sales estimates, everyone on Wall Street says, oh my God, the sky is falling. And then some other analysts hear that and they're like, oh my God, the sky is falling. And the next thing you know, you have a full-blown recession on your hands. Home Depot, Lowe's, UPS, FedEx. If you keep an eye on those four companies and keep an eye on the earnings news for those four companies, they are the canaries in the coal mine. They will give you some insight into what Wall Street is thinking. And if you see bad news, especially right now, you can expect Wall Street to react badly. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. Back in just a moment with the strangest things from the past week and my favorite thing from the coming week here on WMFO Medford.
Scent fragrance at Helena Rubinstein counters everywhere.
Suddenly, you are all of the things that you want to be. A little bit naughty, but heavenly in heaven sent. Heaven sent.
If you're a single man under the age of 35, you'd probably like to know what the ladies are looking for on an online dating site. A guy who had a few drinks and later got pulled over for buzz driving. See, that could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. And doesn't a guy who's back living with his parents but calls them my roommates just scream, Mr. Right?
Buzzed, busted, and broke. Because buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Everything is awesome.
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. A time for What's Hot, my favorite thing from the past or upcoming week. And I'm going to be in New Hampshire this weekend. I'm going up to Lake Winnipesaukee, which is awesome. But I am kind of bummed out because I am going to miss an event that I wind up inevitably missing every year, even though I really, really want to go to this. And I'm going to recommend this to anyone who needs some decor. Maybe you need to freshen up your walls. Maybe you just like a trip down memory lane. Maybe you're into old stuff. Maybe you're into nostalgia. This weekend, this Saturday and Sunday, definitely on Saturday, I think it's going to be Saturday and Sunday, is the 76th Paper Mania Plus Vintage Paper and Ephemera Show. And this is going to be at the XL Center in Hartford, Connecticut. A little bit of a drive, but not terrible. And Paperama Plus, this is the longest running antique ephemera and collectibles show. It's been good. This is their 76th one. So what is ephemera? Ephemera is paper. It's posters. It's lobby cards. It's matchbooks. It's newspapers. It's sports memorabilia. Anything that was printed, anything that's on paper or cardboard or posters or things of that nature. I love collectibles like this because you can frame them and put them on your wall. And people will look at them and be like, wow, that's cool. That's awesome. Where'd you get that? It's a great chance to see what daily life was like years ago. Because the things that turn up at shows like this are supermarket posters and advertising signs. And things from sports events. And postcards, as I mentioned. And matchbooks. And printed pads. And business signs. All of the things that just sort of got handed around and looked at that informed people in years past. Shows like this are a tremendous amount of fun. And you're going to see a very wide variety. This is one of the most preeminent ephemera shows in the country. And I've been trying to get to it for years. I'm going to miss it again this year. Hopefully you won't. It's in Hartford, Connecticut. It's $9 at the door. And I will tell you, if you're looking for something interesting to hang up in your kitchen, or you're looking for something interesting to hang up in your bedroom or your hallway, maybe something to put up in your office that says a little bit about who you are and will be a great conversation piece, this is a great place to go and check it out. So it'll be at the Hartford XL Center in Hartford, Connecticut, One Civic Center Plaza. If you would like more details about this, you will find them on boston.com. Just check out their events section, and they will tell you everything you need to know. 76 Paper Mania Plus Vintage Paper and Ephemera Show. Go check it out. It's shows like this are a lot of fun. I promise. Where's your head at? And we close out, as we do always, with That's a Thing That Happened, the strangest story from the past week. Florida. It's always Florida, isn't it? This is why you don't drink and shop. John Davis, 59 and old enough to know better, decided he had better places to be after he wandered into a St. Petersburg Walmart. So he hopped on one of their in-store electric scooters, rode it out the door, and rode it right out of the parking lot. In fact, he rode it for about a mile before the battery gave out. Police caught Davis at a nearby gas station where he was trying to recharge the scooter using an electrical outlet. Police noted that Davis was still intoxicated. I don't know if operating an electric scooter while intoxicated is a crime in Florida. I'm going to guess it is. Don't take the electric scooter. I don't know why they don't have a thing on the electric scooter that stops it from going past the lot. I guess they just figure the battery's going to die soon enough that you're not going to get far. And in this case, they were true. That is about all the time that we have for this week on the Tell Mikey D, coming your way in just a couple of seconds here on WMFO Medford. Remember, folks, we have a beautiful weekend coming up. Get out there and enjoy it. Get out there. This is a great weekend for outdoor activities, whether you're into golfing, hiking, logging. It's going to be a great weekend for logging. A great weekend for fishing. Not so much a great weekend for